Good evening. You are listening to The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio, Chinatown's only micro-broadcasting radio station for the arts. I am Nicholas Miller, here, as ever, sweating it out with the inimitable Steve Cato. Why don't you say hi,
Hello.
Steve Cato?
Oh, hi. To our listeners at home, I'm sorry if there's a lot of fan sound. I'm just sitting in front of a box fan here in the studio trying to get through this incredible flat roof heat we have here. As you know, I'm a flat roofer, so
which means he doesn't believe in the Middle Ages. Yeah, and you know, we love Solomon to death, but his the remnants of all of his mycelia projects create a nice film on the inside of the studio in the vents throughout the summer, so it's kind of like we're inside of like a non-breathable mushroom. It's warm.
Thanks, soul.
It's warm. Yeah, it's true. How are you doing this week, Steve?
Oh, you know, pretty good, I guess. I handed in some freelance work so I can take a little bit of a break and get organized for the next round of freelance type work. My spouse is going on a epic work trip to Tanzania.
Mamma mia.
Yeah, I know. So we've been preparing for that. You know, obviously I like to be helpful, but most of the time I just feel jealous.
Is how you're preparing for the trip?
Yeah, just stewing. Well, no, you know, but it's like, you know, Meredith's like, should I get this? Should I get that? You know, what's best, this or that? You know, like,
are these like small televisions or bug sprays or what are we talking about here?
Yeah, hats. You know, it's interesting. There's certain colors that are inappropriate for trips to Africa, apparently. There's certain colors that attract mosquitoes, which I wasn't aware of. And maybe that's not true of our domestic mosquitoes, but you really don't want to get a mosquito bite in a country where they carry malaria.
Ooh.
You want to try and avoid getting malaria, I guess, is one of the things. And then there's like all these other colors that are... you can't wear red. It's like if you're going to be around some of the wild animals.
Rhinoceri.
It enrages them. And then you can't, you know, so there's just stuff like that where it's like wow, okay. So it's like, no, you know, it's like usually I try and get away with just taking stuff I've already got when I go on a trip.
The whole cherry red portion of your wardrobe would be verboten.
I mean, definitely. And I mean, I wear a red shirt very often, actually.
I was thinking about you in this instance.
So, and then a lot of the other clothes I wear are blue.
Those attract mosquitoes?
Yeah, which, you know, is apparently a highway to getting malaria, which my understanding is that that really sucks.
So your fashion sensibility would just get you... very ill and then trampled to death, basically.
Yeah. And then Meredith typically wears black all the time, which is just from a practical standpoint bad in this context. Hot. Although I'm reminded, actually, and this is like maybe a slight tie-in to our guest, that when the Bader Meinhof gang, the Red Army faction, were training in the Middle East, the sort of PLO guys that they were training with were really mad at them for not wearing fatigues, but for just wearing their, like, you know, black tight jeans and like black shirt, you know, like dressing like a rock and roll badass, being the sort of Bader Meinhof house style, you know. It's like an issue of some consternation that they refused to, that they wanted to do maneuvers in like tight denim, which, you know, I say, be yourself. You know, we don't know the names of any of those PLO guys for their style. And the only thing we know about the Bader-Meinhof. If you know one thing about the Bader-Meinhof gang, you've seen them in a Gerhard Richter painting, and you thought that they were like maybe stylish looking.
Yeah.
What do I know? Anyway, there's just been like a lot of wardrobe discussions. You have to buy a whole new set of everything. All that kind of stuff. Fascinating.
Yeah. Jeez. So you're going to be flying solo for quite a while.
Yeah, it's exciting. It's I wonder what'll happen.
Yeah, I feel like you probably do well with some solitude.
You know, there's part of me for sure that is going to enjoy a little time to myself, but then there's also, you know, I get lonely. The last couple times we've been apart for different work reasons, I've definitely felt a little mopey. Aww. You know.
Yeah, I can relate.
I'm trying to not overdo it on the sauce, but one of the things that did happen the last time was I just would get like day drunk by myself. And that wasn't good. Hopefully I'll just do more exotic exploring, you know? Like I've been wanting to do more cycling in the Angeles National Forest.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe now's the time when I can, you know, drive somewhere exotic and bike around or something like that.
Yeah, I mean, you'll have unfettered access to the family car.
Yeah, the Honda Fit is mine, all mine.
Yeah, that'll be liberating in a spatial sense.
Yeah, and I'll be kind of in between big work projects, so it'll be, it would be the ideal time for me to kick off some new work projects, but maybe I'll just take it as a little California staycation, go read at the beach in the mornings or something.
Ooh, very nice.
Yeah, but who knows? Who's to say? How about you? How are you doing?
I'm pretty good. Hunkered down. I mean, I'm in the state before the state where you hand in the freelance work.
Yeah.
Which is a busy time, but yeah, it's been kind of a slow-ish spell, so I appreciate the effects of handing in work.
Working. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I wish you didn't have to do it ever at all for anybody.
Yeah,
but,
no.
You know, I've gotten to the age where I realize that sometimes it's nice to have some money around. But I'm going to San Francisco next week. Also good place to have some money around in.
Yeah, pricey town.
Is it? I can't remember. I haven't been there a long time. In my memory, it's kind of pricey, but
it's not cheap. I mean, yeah. It's pretty good. There's like nice stuff.
I have a very affordable place to stay, so that's nice.
What are your plans for SF?
Just check in with friends. You know, there's like I'm trying to get better about that kind of thing.
Yeah, good.
Like I'm not going there with any agenda other than seeing people and checking on their lives and seeing what they're up to. And I don't know, I'll probably only have 3 or 4 good friends up there, but I don't see them enough. So it's also
enjoy some seafood.
Yeah, and it's very hot here. So it's a great time to go up there.
Yeah.
I'm taking the train, which I'm excited about.
Oh, wow. Doesn't the train put you on a bus a bunch of the time?
There are
from
two
like San
trains.
San Luis Obispo?
Yeah, the main route is to go to San Luis Obispo and then take a bus up. I'm taking the Coast Starlight, which is just one train the whole way up.
Really?
Yeah. Which leaves
I thought that the train.
Day.
I thought there was a train collapse or something.
Well, they sold me a ticket a couple of days ago, so I hope not.
Yeah.
But, I mean, if I go down to the trains, the Coast Starlight supposedly leaves Union Station every morning at 9 and gets into San Francisco at 9 p.m., so it's a 12-hour shift.
Wow.
But I guess I'm in the luxurious position that if I go down there and they biff it, I'll just come get my car and drive to San Francisco.
Wow.
But, yeah.
That's crazy.
Yeah, I didn't buy a return train ticket back because we'll see how it goes.
Yeah, exactly.
I might be flying back.
Yeah. But easy enough to do.
The train ticket up is $60, so I was like,
wow.
Even if I have to buy a last minute plane ticket, that'll kind of even everything out. Cause it'll
That's good.
It'll definitely take me a tank or two of gas, which is about $75 a pop for me.
Yeah, you have a truck.
Yeah, so you know, I was like, this is better for everybody involved if I take the
train. Wow.
Also, something nice about being in San Francisco and not having a car, because then it's like,
yeah,
come to me. Like, hey, friends, come to me.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We'll see how that works out.
Wow.
Anywho, I might be full of tall tales. You'll hear all about them in my retelling, which is a kind of awkward segue into our guest this evening.
Yeah, that was kind of awkward.
You know, you can't. You
normally, we've been very smooth. I don't mean to knock you off course again, but I just want to say to our one listener out there, I hope you've appreciated how smooth our transitions have been, our segues have been these last couple episodes. We've really done some great work. We've really moved the conversation around deftly, I would say. And I'm proud of us.
Well, I was waiting for you to, you know, jump in with a story of, you know, love lost and distance and solitude and, you know, traveling to lakes and summoning nude women. But it just didn't come, Steve.
You know, my days of summoning nude women at lakes is behind me.
Okay, okay. Well, I think without further ado, we've invited the incredible contemporary filmmaker all the way from Germany, Christian Petzold, who's here in the studio tonight with Lincoln Film Center director Dennis Lim and his translator friend. So everyone, put your hands together for Christian Petzold.
Christian, I'm just going to start by asking you to maybe say a little bit about the appeal of mythology and fairy tales for you. I feel like one of the defining qualities of your work is this tension between, on the one side, realism, and on the other side, whatever you want to call it, fantasy, dreams, genre, myth. And I feel like Undina is a film in which you maybe push the furthest into that side of things.
For me, you know, I'm living in Germany, and we, the Germans, we love our literature, and we love not so much the cinema. For us, cinema, it's a medium to transport literature. But for me, cinema has more to do with oral history, with oral stories, with songs, fairy tales. Yeah? And it's more for the people, yeah, and not for the literature clubs and circles. Yeah? And so I'm always, I have two children, now they're adult, but I have read all the German fairy tales by Gebrüder Grimm or Hauff to them. And I can feel that there is an experience, a popular experience in them. And this is something what I can find also in the very early cinema I'd like until today, if it's Murnau, yeah, if Murnau's based on myths and legends, and also Fritz Lang loves it, yeah, and this is a tradition we have lost a little bit in Germany, because now we want to be serious after Second World War. We are just serious, yeah, no fairy tales anymore, and for me, also the cinemas near the train station with their cheap stories, with their sexualized stories, with things which happen, the crime stories, the pulp stories. This is for me cinema, and this is my fundament. Huh?
Foundation.
Yes.
Foundation.
Mm-hmm. Oh, foundation. That's very good.
Can you say a little bit about this particular myth, the Undina myth, which I think maybe occupies a particular role in German mythology, and maybe for German speakers has maybe a different significance from people outside Germany?
I must say, when I read this book from by Spoto about Alfred Hitchcock, huh? There are some chapters in where Alfred Hitchcock is a male subject filled up with a sexual desire for his blonde actress, huh? And this book reduced Hitchcock a little bit, but remember that in this book the word mermaid or nymph or undine was in. It's a story about the a male desire and a male projection and a woman as an object. Yeah? And it's like this. And so we, Nina Hoss and I, we discuss it, this undine myth, since 20 years, yeah? Because it's a setting, yeah? It's a setting of a male director and a blonde actress. Yeah, it's a little bit like a female blonde singer in a male jazz group or so. Yeah, it's always the same projection. And then I like the fairy tale or the myth behind, because it's more complicated than this 3-4 sentences I can talk about this. It's when you are in love with someone, yeah, and this one doesn't love you back, yeah, and you are very alone and you are near committing suicide, there is in this myth there is a possibility. You can go into a forest. There is a small pond in this forest where Undine is living in, and you can shout out her name, you call her, and she's coming out of the water, naked, always naked, long hair, and very beautiful, and she come to you, and she embrace you, yeah, and she will say, I'm yours forever, and this is a contract, and when you want me, yeah, then the contract is signed. And if you leave me, I have to kill you, and I have to go back into this pond and wait for the next guy. Yeah? And this guy says, oh, you are so beautiful, I never want to leave you. Like all men, you know, this story is men and prostitutes, I take you out here, you are my lover, and so on. Yeah? And so this guy takes Undine with him into his life, into his social life. And because he is now, yeah, in company to this beautiful young woman, the other woman is now interested again in him, yeah? And so he goes back to the original, yeah? And leaves Undine alone, and Undine has to kill him. And this is the picture I like so much in this novel or myth by Fouquet from the 19th century, a romantic writer. Undine came into the marriage suite, yeah, where the guy's lying in bed with this woman, and she's in a bubble of water, and she take him for a last hug, yeah, into this bubble until he's what's the word, drawn? He's drawn? No,
drowned.
No.
Yeah. Drowned. Yeah.
Drowned. Yeah. 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 And then the water is going out of her. She's standing there naked, yeah, and she said, my tears killed him to death. Yeah, and so as the water, it's the tear. And this I like so much this picture, and this was the basis of Undine. Yeah, but the real basis was that I've read a book by Ingeborg Bachmann about this legend, about this myth, and in this book she. She's telling the story from out of the perspective from Undine. She said, I don't want to be the desire of men and grab an identity by a man's desire anymore. I want to be by my own. Yeah? And this is this was the start of making this script and this movie. Long answer, sorry.
Yeah. No. So to follow up on that, a question about writing, and actually, because you've often worked with existing texts, or sort of, you know, adapted in a way, like Transit and Phoenix are based on texts, and you've also in a way adapted or sort of worked with existing films, like The Postman Always Rings Twice or Carnival of Souls. I'm wondering if the process of Do you think that this is like a process of adaptation when you're working with a myth like this? Or because, you know, this is a myth that itself has been, as you've suggested in your last answer, already been adapted and changed many times over the years.
Yeah, I think that cinema don't have to be very original. Yeah, it can. I think adaptations. Adaptations. When I saw two Howard Hawks movies, they are based on the same script. Yeah, there are 10 years between them. Yeah, it's totally different movie. And I like this on Tales that someone is telling you a story. And this guy goes to another guy who is telling the same story, but it changed a little bit. Yeah? And so I like this on cinema, this oral thing that you are a very bad witness, yeah? and you're telling your own point of from your own point of view, a new perspective of something. For example, The Postman Always Rings Twice. Haroon Farocki and I, we read the book by James M. Cain. Yeah? We have done it in Berkeley together because I have to learn English and therefore I have to read it. And Haroon told me for him, this book is, it's a book about the class struggle in the USA. And I said, for me, when I read the book, it's about racism because this guy's Greece. Yeah? And the Americans want to kill him and want to have his money. It's a racism story, yeah. And so we have two perspectives. And then I came to Germany, and my wife is Turkey, and I think about the east part of Germany. So many fascists, neo-fascists there. And the book by James M. Cain find a new space and also a new social structure. And so it's for me, it's also a new story. And this happened also with Undine, yeah? which you can do as a period picture or fairy tale picture or picture for the afternoon television. Yeah, it's I always have to find a position to tell the story. And the position for me was the perspective of Undine, who's living there, and the first time in her life, she for herself started to laugh, and she's not only being laughed.
Right.
Yeah, it's okay.
Yep. That was great. I wanted to ask about your decision to work with the two actors from Transit, Paolo Baer and Franz Rogowski again here. I think the idea of the ghost is a significant one in your work. And in some ways, Undina seems to me to be a film that's haunted by your other films. And I think maybe this idea of the actors carrying over has something to do with that. Can you say about your decision to work with Paolo and Franz again?
Yeah, I must say that the time in Marseille when we made Transit for me was a really new experience. I have two actors with Franz and Paola who are not part of this big German players education and this big theater education schools in Germany, where you find a special style of playing. I don't like it so much. Yeah? And these two are the first who never have been in a school like that. Yeah? Franz is a dancer. And Paula, as a young girl, she was also a dancer, and she make everything by herself. And so in Transit, I have two new styles of acting. It's more dancing. It's more thinking about the space, not about the dialogue so much. And it was, for me, it was a fantastic experience. And then at the 28th day of shooting, we are in a little melancholical mood, yeah? Very sentimental because it's going to an end and we have to leave some of the shooting places forever. And then we three are sitting on a table in a pizzeria, yeah, where we had shoot a movie for more than 10 days. And I said, okay, Paula, you are dying in the sea. Yeah, you are. Schiffbruch, I don't know.
No, you're being shipwrecked.
Shipwrecked, yeah.
shepherd. And so you, Franz, you are on land in a harbor, and you are waiting. Perhaps the dead Marie, was Paula's name in the movie. Perhaps Marie will come back from the dead. Yeah? And so the next movie, it's so that she is coming out of the water to look and search for him. And he's going as a diver into the water to look and search for her. And so I have a little bit that Undine and Transit has something to do also for biographical for the actors.
Yeah. Right. And so, but this is sort of how you work usually. There usually is a relationship to a previous work. And you also have been conceptualizing the films as loose trilogies with the period films. And then this one, you're saying is your elements trilogy, right? So you start with water.
Yeah, that's right. And now I'm writing on fire. The red sky is the name of the next movie. But we'll realize the movie when the pandemic is gone, not before, because it's always also something to do with love, yeah? And kissing and homosexual love too, and I want to see bodies and so on. And I can't do it with masks and so on. I want to do it the real. Yeah? But you're right. I'm a Protestant, and someone asked me about the element water in Undine, and I said I'm working on a trilogy, because I want to set myself on fire. To work on with two other things. I have no idea, but now I have to do the trilogy. This is an old trick by Harun Farocki. He said, always make thinking about trilogies so we have to work on. And you are thinking in serials and patterns, and you're working on the difference, I would say, in France, and so this I like to work a little bit like in the 40s and the 50s, the people make one movie after another, and they have a correlation. You know?
I wanted to come back to a question about the character of Undina, and can you talk about how you conceptualized her job at the museum, and also how you see this, the history of Berlin? I mean, that is I think another important aspect of the film. How that fits in with your exploration of this myth?
I have a metaphorical picture in my head. It's for example, when you can see how many forests are burning in the world, not just in California and Brazil and all the wild animals, they come out, yeah? because they are burning, yeah, and then there's no space for them to live on, yeah. It, for me, I have the same idea for Undine, that we dried out our country, yeah, because we are building canals, we are destroying the nature, and so we also destroying the black forest, the dark waters, all these spaces where fairy tales and nightmare stories could have happened. Yeah. So we are losing the space and the rooms and the moods from fairy tales. Yeah. And I have this picture that you see a dried sea, yeah, or a dried lake, and the fishes are lying on and drying on the ground, no water anymore. And for me, Undine is like this fish. Yeah, she. There is no lake. There is no water. There is no myth anymore. Yeah? No miracle. No bewitched things. Yeah, and so she has to work. Yeah, and so she is working about the history of Berlin. It's a story about drying out a region to build up a city. This is Berlin means swamp. Yeah, the word Berlin means swamp, and how she's telling in the movie, on the other hand, the meaning is a dried swamp, and on dried swamp, Berlin is built up. Yeah, and so you have the swamp where the fairy tales and the myths are, and you have the city where everything is out. Yeah? So you understand this? This is really?
Yeah, that makes sense.
Don't lie to me.
But what about what is significant to you about the building that is discussed in you know, the scene where she previews the presentation? Can you say a little bit?
This is, I must say, during the premiere, the female minister for culture was sitting beside me, and with this part of the movie she was totally nervous, yeah, because this is really ridiculous what we are had made there. This was there was a palace, yeah, in the Prussia time, yeah. And this palace was destroyed during the war, yeah? Second World War, by bombs. Yeah? The German Democratic Republic, the communists, put away the rest of the ruins and built a new palace of the people. Yeah? Der Palast der Republik. A really ugly place, I must say. Yeah? A really ugly place, but it's a place. Yeah? It's representing them. Yeah? And after 89, when the capitalistic world has won the war, yeah, the Cold War, they destroyed this again and they built up the old palace, yeah, from 1750 or so. But inside the palace, just the
shell. The outer.
Yeah, they built just the shell of this palace, and inside there's a mall and a museum. And I must say, What thinking of history is this in Berlin? And Paula Baer or Undine is telling us the story, and you can see it. She makes it in a very intelligent way. As during she's talking about this, we have a real audience by people from the university, and she has to speak very, very clever and very good, and she's doing so good that the minister besides me during the premiere was really nervous, and she's always talking in my ear. I'm not responsible for this. I'm not responsible for this. this I like very much.
I just wanted to come back to ask you about water. One question I had was just the practical, or maybe just formal, practical challenges or sort of formal ideas that you had with water being such an important part of the film. Water has been an important part of many of your films, but here I think you kind of go further with actually shooting quite a bit underwater. And I know you've been working with the same DP, Hans Fromm, for many years, and I'm just wondering if there were new challenges, new situations in this film for both of you.
Yeah, we have long discussions. It could have been better if we had used computer animations, cheaper, not better, cheaper. Yeah, but I'm an old fan of Ray Harryhausen. Yeah, I must say I love these movies. Yeah, because, and also I said to the both actors Paula and Franz that we build up a real world. Yeah, a real world with real fish and real underwater world. And we have seen movies, for example, I can give you a good example. In this movie by Charles Laughton, Night of the Hunter, you can see the dead Shelley Winters in a car, yeah, underwater. Mm-hmm. Yeah, she's dead. And her hair, her blonde hair, is like this
seaweed.
The seaweed, yeah, wow, yeah, fantastic, yeah. And this is the physical, it's a physical impression I have. I showed that to the actors and also to the set designers. And I said, how we can do this underwater world like this? And they say, okay, we need a big tank, a really big tank, yeah, but we need a water temperature very high, 38 degrees, yeah, because of the diving and the working underwater and so on. But 38 degrees means that when we have sea wood, yeah, underwater, and 38 degrees, it start directly to get algae.
Algae, yeah.
algae. So we nobody, it's like poisoned water then. Yeah? And so we have to work for more than four weeks with artificial botanic things, yeah, to find the Shelley Winters hair, for example, like this. And but it was a fantastic experience because we have shoot the first 5 days underwater with the actors in this bewitched world, what we have there underwater. So also they are impressed, and I need to impress the actors that they can impress us. It's like this. And if we have done it in front of a green screen or blue screen, this is nothing. There's no power inside of this.
So just one last question. The last time you were here, you caused a bit of a stir by declaring yourself a fan of Den of Thieves.
Oh my God, I remember.
Yes.
So many people bought this record now.
So I'm wondering if you have any updates, anything else you've liked recently that might surprise people.
I must say I've seen some movies in the last time. First Cow, you know all these movies, I'm sure. Mm-hmm. First Cow I like very much. The Souvenir by Johanna Hook I like very much. The Safdie Brothers movie is great, yeah? The last one. Yeah. Okay, and so I think it's not really new stuff I've found. I infected myself with COVID in March and April. And I have seen many, many movies, but I must say, I make a film festival by my own based on my DVD library. Yeah? And this was the best festival I ever has been. I have seen two Ozu movies, one Bresson movie, three Chabrol movies. It was movies I know, but I have seen them on another in another mood, or also as something very new. So I hope that we in the future we have curated programs, yeah? Really curated programs. Therefore, I hate Amazon and Netflix. It's not curated. It's for me. I've had a headache after. So now I'm based on my DVD. But I must Uncut Gems. It's a Netflix production. I remember it, but it was not in the German cinemas. Yeah? It's just on screen, and this is really fantastic work. I was a little bit disappointed about that.
How are you doing now? Have you fully recovered?
I'm fully recovered, and I hope so. That there was no flashback or this. But I must say the dreams are not so bad. Yeah? I have the fever dreams. Ah. Some of them are X-rated, yeah? But. But many of them are really fantastic, and I've bought a novel by Simenon. Yeah, I want to make a movie out, and I said no to this because it was too dystopian.
Yeah,
and I changed into this fire story, Red Sky, because I want when I said to myself when I'm healthy again and out of this shitty bed, yeah? I want to work on love and young people and not about a world which is in a breakdown situation.
I mean, maybe the fever dreams will be good for the fire movie. So
two of them are inside the script. Yeah. Yeah. And one of the X-rated too.
can't wait. We have to get you back here for that one. But it's too bad you couldn't join us, but we're delighted to have the film. Christian will also be participating in a live talk with the director Heinz Amigholz later in the festival. So stay tuned for details of that. Christian, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Wow.
Wowza. That was great.
Yeah.
Yeah. Geez. I mean, I feel like there are so many things to say. What did you think, Steve?
Well, I really enjoyed the part where he said that, you know, the role of being a filmmaker is not to like be original.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause I think that like in lots of ways that's true. You know, like I think like and you can see it in Barbenheimer weekend just now, for example, right, where it's like, oh, you know, like this famous this movie about a famous historical figure and this, you know, based on a biography of a famous historical figure.
Barbie's and, not that famous of a historical figure.
Well, and then this like very well-known intellectual property.
Which is which? I'm confused, Steve.
But you know, it's like we know who these people are, kind of thing. We're not like watching this to find out who these people are.
That's true.
Necessarily, or what they do. You know, like we know what Barbie does, and we know what John Robert Oppenheimer did. You know, an interesting thing about Oppenheimer from his brother, who's the creator of the San Francisco Exploratorium, like Max Oppenheimer or Jeff Oppenheimer or whatever his brother's name was. His brother was also there at the Trinity test. And, you know, the story, right, is that, like, Oppenheimer's just got, like, this quote from the Bhagavad Gita on tap when the bomb goes off. And apparently, according to Bobo, Jeff, whatever his brother's name is, the founder of the San Francisco Exploratorium, where you will go and meet your friends after traveling there by train, at the Exploratorium, apparently Oppenheimer just said, huh, it worked.
Yeah.
Which is, I think, 1,000% more believable. Like, when are you going to do something complicated, test it out, and then just like flip into sort of mythic mode? Like, the first thing you're going to say is like, gee, you know, golly. Wow, it worked. You know, like I definitely know what I'd be saying if I was in his shoes. I would definitely be saying, wow, it worked.
Holy shucks.
Fuck! did you see that? Anyway. But yeah, we know what everyone's about. We know what everyone's doing in these contexts. We don't need to be told. We don't need to have other information. I think that's also true of sort of, you know, mythic stories, you know, so using this, this mythic framework for stories set in contemporary times, you know, like, I don't think he needs to call the movie Undine to make it about that figure. You know what I mean? Like, he's kind of helping people out, you know, but like, there's just tons of times where people are like, oh yeah, you know, that's Oedipus again. That's this, that's that, you know, like these stories are sort of infinitely recyclable. And it's really just about like demonstrating how you do it both technically and practically. And that's why we've also just got, you know, we don't have very original stories in cinema, even when really fancy people are doing them, you know, like what's the story of like the, you know, the color of pomegranates or something like that. You know, it's like, it's pretty basic, but like the color of pomegranates is like, really about how the story gets told, not like what the story itself is, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. I think that they call this adaptation in the talk.
Yeah.
And maybe that's all film can do anymore.
Well, I think, or I think maybe his point is that that's sort of structurally all film's capable of, you know, and that's, there's no shame in that really. Cause he mentions his friend Farocki a lot. It's also nice when people get to talk about Haroon Farocki. You know, that's something we like to do here on the Talking Show. You know, I know at least for a while, Nicholas was a subscriber to the New Left Review, you know, like, where
still am card carrying member,
where people talk about Farocki the most, I think in the English language. I don't think another magazine has covered Farocki more.
Yeah.
October, a distant second. And you know, like, Petzl was talking about discussing basically the same story, the same James M. Cain story with Farocki, and Farocki sees it as about class conflict and he sees it as about something else. And so both of them could shoot the same movie. You know what I mean? Like both of them could shoot the same script. It would be, there's no problem with that. You know, like I think, at least not to Petzold. And I thought that was really good. You know, I think that I'm not trying to downplay the role of writers, obviously, in this moment of them being on strike. But I do think that, that's not what movies are.
You know, in a way, it's like what filmmaking actually has to offer the aesthetic regime. It's not really allowed to do. It's kind of stuck in this narrative mode. It's kind of like, like theater plus technical reproduction. Whereas maybe more like structuralist film or something does something that only it can do, but nobody cares about that stuff anymore.
Yeah, no. Also, there's only so many times you could make a film that's about zooming in.
Yeah. Or like something. Pure duration or something.
Yeah. I mean, like, you know, R.I.P. Michael Snow, but there's a reason why I think some of those moves weren't really repeated.
Yeah. Because it kind of, right? it did what it's supposed to do. It's like, you know, Einstein wrote his equation. They don't keep rewriting it.
Yeah, exactly. You know, he made the zoom in movie. He made the pan movie. He made the track movie. He really did.
Yeah.
You know, and then that's pretty good. You know, like that. Like people saw that and were like, "Well, I'm convinced." You know, like, thank you, Michael Snow. And then then we don't need to make the zoom in movie anymore. I feel like. Oh, on a side note, the funny part is the one movie I do feel myself sort of compelled to somehow remake is actually La Région Centrale, because it's kind of none of those things. It's this weird, expressive, very long film. And I feel like that's like something where I feel like I'd be compelled to take that shot again, make a different Région Centrale, shoot it in 3D. make people barf. I've never seen any of Petzold's films, which comes to mind as well. So it was nice to hear him talk about them. Although, like, I kind of wish that, as they discussed this, the actors involved and the sort of interaction of him working with the same actors and the description sounds cool. I just have no idea what the scoop about that is.
Well, he talks here and there about A Fire, which is out now. I've known about him for a couple of years now and I've really been wanting to watch them and haven't. And for some reason was compelled to invite him out here to chat first before getting into it, which isn't normally my way with a filmmaker. But now I'm surprised to say I'm more compelled to see them, which isn't always the case.
That's true.
So I think, I'll start with Undine, and then maybe move on to Transit, which was friend of the show Chris Carlton recommended to me when it came out. There's some kind of play with history. It makes sense given the his talk tonight. It's like kind of feels like a World War II film, but everyone's wearing contemporary Adidas shoes or something. There's like these little, like some moments are really strictly period, and then like real laziness seems on purpose as well. That sounded quite compelling to me.
Well, you'll have to share those with me. I'm curious as well, and I understand that you've already gone through the trouble of getting these from Karagarga. So,
Well, I'll share them with you, Steve. Deal.
Thanks, man.
Deal. Well, I guess I was going to say something about film being a bad witness, but I think we've already kind of covered that in our chat about adaptation. It feels nice to hear an artist talk about doing it the way you see it. and kind of just that's good enough. It's like, well, this is how you saw it, and this is how it came out, and there's no real system of aesthetic judgment in place at the moment anyway. So what do you really have to appeal to other than that as an artist? So thanks a lot, Christian.
Yeah, thanks, man. Nice to see you.
We can't wait to watch your films.
Maybe that's what I'll do while my spouse is away. I'll get caught up on all the cinema.
Yeah, Petzold.
I haven't been watching.
Yeah. Oh, there's one that I'm supposed to watch with Ian. I'll let you know when that,
oh,
when
yeah,
that comes about. It's
what are you guys supposed to watch?
Unrest.
What's the deal with that?
I hadn't heard of it, but apparently Ian reads the film section of Art Forum magazine, which he says is great, and it was recommended in there a few months ago. And it's the story of Swiss watch factory workers taking over the factory, which, you know, another friend of the show is quite fond of that narrative as well.
Well, maybe we should run a little screening series at Leroy's or something like that. To get caught up on everything that we've torrented and haven't gotten around to watching. That sounds great. I love the sounds of that. I've gotten a lot of Japanese avant-garde movies from the 60s that are probably, like, pretty upsetting, but that, you know, nevertheless, I promised myself I would watch. So there's that stuff.
Yeah, there can be a Petzold night, an unrest anarcho night, and then an unsettling Japanese anime night.
There's a, oh no, these are live action movies.
Oh, live action, oh my goodness.
Yeah, okay. It's like in and around the sort of like extreme leftist politics of the late 60s and early 70s when like the Maoist groups in Japan were murdering themselves in self-criticism. Really insane stuff, hijacking airplanes. Making very unsettling, apparently, cinema. Playing in that band Les Relis Denudés, that kind of world.
Okay, I know that people are really into that band, and I've only listened to the recordings and not looked into them at all. But I was curious.
Yeah,
I was like, there must be some other value here than just
bass
this
player
noise.
Still imprisoned for hijacking an airplane in the '70s.
Holy smokes!
Yeah, that's really putting it on the line. You know, it's like when I was a teen. I was into, you know, like the makeup, you know, Ian Svenonius, where they're like sort of like a fake terrorist group, right? Like that's their whole thing, is they're like these political subversives, you know, but it's like very theatrical, very based on like the pictures of the Bader-Meinhof gang and not actually, you know, like literally just a touring band from Washington, D.C. And then to have like Les Relis Denudés, like, you know, the bass player out there hijacking an airplane, really potent, really not the kind of thing you see every day, you know, like, anyway. So yeah. Oh, the other thing is actually this guy, Rudy something, this Swiss director who directed this, a bunch of sort of weird, the movie Grauzone and also the movie, Hohenfeuer, Alpine Fire. I don't know. He's this, apparently a really big deal Swiss director. I'm curious.
Well, it's the perfect time of year to sit in darkened rooms that are hopefully cool.
Yeah. Well, Leroy's isn't. I was there today. It's warm. But, yeah. Anyway, good luck to us.
Yes. Good morning, Chinatown.
Good night.